Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. This is Mike Consul. Thank you, as always, for joining us. In the spotlight is Roy Peter Clark. He is an American writer, editor, and writing coach. He's a senior scholar and vice president at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, a place I've visited a couple different times. If you're not familiar with the Poynter Institute, it's probably because you're not in journalism, but it's a journalism think tank based in St. Petersburg, Florida. And it is one of those places where you learn to write and report and interview, use social media and so on at a very high level. And I think back, I've known Roy Peter Clark by name for many, many years. I've never met him in person, so I'm really glad to have him on the program. I met one of his mentors, Don Fry, a couple of times at the Poynter Institute. So Roy Peter Clark is also the author and editor of 18 books. His most recent include Writing Tools, The Glamour of Grammar, Help, put an exclamation point after Help for Writers, and How to Write Short. And the one we're going to be talking about today, not exclusively necessarily, but The Art of X-Ray Reading. And he will explain what X-ray reading really is. And I have to tell you that when people say, what's the best writing books you've read? There's three that I would tell people. Well, two in particular, The Art and Craft of Feature Writing by Bill Blundell, who actually gets a mention in the book we're going to be talking about. The other is Sin and Syntax by Constance Hale. And I often will throw in Story by screenwriter Robert McKee, which is a terrific book that very focused on storytelling. But I will add to that list now, having just read The Art of X-Ray Reading. I just completed that book. I will add The Art of X-Ray Reading. It's a really great piece of writing. And that's the thing about, you see people write writing books and then the writing in the writing book is bland. That's not the case with Bill Blundell or Constance Hale or Robert McKee. It's actually electrifying. And this also holds true for Roy Peter Clark. His book is just outstanding. And he's one of those writers who writes about writing. He's got a enormous passion for it, as do I, and I think all of our listeners do as well. Roy Peter Clark, with that, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's tremendously happy for me to be with you in a conversation from one end of the country to the other. It's great to talk and celebrate the craft.
So you're in St. Petersburg, is that right, Roy?
Yeah, I've been living in St. Petersburg, Florida since 1977. I was born in the Lower East Side of New York City. I grew up on Long Island, went to school in New England, and then headed south for a career as a young young English professor, and managed to stumble really by accident into journalism, and have been with the Poynter Institute and with the Tampa Bay Times newspaper since the 1970s.
In the Tampa Bay Times is almost like a that is a newspaper, an experimental newspaper. Now, you check me on this, but it's where a lot of the concepts that are developed at the Poynter Institute are actually executed. Is that right? And tested?
So the Institute is a nonprofit school that owns what was originally the St. Petersburg Times, now the Tampa Bay Times, winner of, I think, 13 Pulitzer Prizes, the inventor of PolitiFact, which won a Pulitzer Prize, which is now housed at the Poynter Institute. So it's a school that owns a newspaper. And of course, like many other newspapers, the Tampa Bay Times has struggled financially, but has always been, for those of us at the Poynter Institute, a place where we could, we could watch news writing in action and learn from it every day.
Yeah. Well, and 13 Pulitzer Prizes. Obviously, what the Poynter Institute is doing is working. Now, I didn't know about PolitiFact. Wow, that's impressive that PolitiFact comes out of the Poynter Institute. So, and that won a Pulitzer Prize as well, as you said. Now, you also have the National Writers Workshop. And before we get into X-ray reading, I just wanted you to tip your hat. And I do know you wear hats sometimes, just from the photography I've seen of you. And not just baseball caps, even though I take it you're a big baseball fan. But you've got the National Writers Workshop. Maybe that's something that I went through when I was at Poynter. I don't even know. What exactly is that? Could you put some flesh on those bones?
It existed. The National Writers Workshop was created in as a kind of a extension of a writing conference, a public writing conference that was held in Wilmington, Delaware, and sponsored by the newspaper there. And I was invited to come and be a speaker. And this was somewhere in the 1990s. And I remember the tremendous enthusiasm by people, not just journalists, but by students, by teachers, by public writers of all kind, who wanted to grow in their craft. And I came back to St. Petersburg and testified at this amazing sort of energy. And over the next decade, the Poynter Institute became the umbrella for I guess up to 10 or 12 different news organizations would sponsor these all over the country. And more than 50,000 people attended these when they were still going on. And the main lesson was that good writing was something that many different kinds of public writers were interested in, not just journalists, and that there was an appetite for people to grow in their craft. And this is essentially what I've always assumed as my mission, not just to help the writers at the Tampa Bay Times, but to really think about what it means to create a sort of a nation of writers, where writing would evolve into as public a literacy as reading is. And I've had more than 40 years, and now I'm working on my 20th book, headed for that goal.
There you go. So all this journalism experience you've got, all this journalism training that you have provided to people, but X-ray reading actually talks about, you take the classics in literature, and you take 25 in that book, but there's obviously many more than that that people can avail themselves of. And you really teach in this book what's called X-ray reading to understand what it is they're doing that is working, so that we can take those lessons and apply them to our own writing. And so this is why I wanted Roy to be on the program, is because here we are, fiction writers. I mean, I'm still a journalist, but I'm also a fiction writer. And the way he analyzes what's being done by people that we all know, like Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Toni Morrison and so on, is extremely instructive. And before we launch into that, Roy, I just want you to X-ray read your own name, because for years I've wondered, why are you not Roy Clark? You're Roy Peter Clark. And what's the X-ray? There's a story behind that. And what's the X-ray reading on that? Or what's the story behind why you use your name, a triple barrel name?
Great question. And I think I have a colorful answer. It begins with the fact that I'm named after my two grandfathers. I grew up in an Italian Jewish family where a lot of relatives, a lot of children were named after dead relatives.
I get it.
I'm laughing about it, right? Roy Clark, my grandfather, died in 1942. I was born in 1948. And I'm delighted. He was apparently a wonderful person. He was an early, just as people, we know the invention of the internet, during the time of Thomas Edison, he was an early electrician and made his trade that way. Now, I was pretty much raised with my Italian grandfather, Peter Marino. And his story of his name is that I have the ship's manifest when he and his family came from Naples to Ellis Island, and he was 4 years old. And Peter is an anglicized, Americanized version of his actual name, which was Pellegrino. And I believe, I wouldn't mind being Roy Pellegrino Clark.
Yeah, it's got panache, cool. For sure.
And check this out. Pellegrino, I think the word means, or is related to the word that means pilgrim. And Marino, the family last name, is Mariner. So here is a four-year-old boy who is a pilgrim mariner on a ship called the Nord America, headed from Italy to Ellis Island, where they would create their new home on the Lower East Side of New York. Now, when I started writing stories for journalism, Mike, I was teaching as a young assistant professor in the early 1970s in Montgomery, Alabama, at a branch campus of Auburn University. And I started writing about my experiences in the South. And I wrote about language. I wrote about religion. I wrote about political culture. And I wrote about country music. And
there's a Roy Clark there, too.
There's a Roy Clark there. And so the New York Times published an op-ed piece that I wrote called Unbuckling the Bible Belt. And it kind of talked to them and said, you know, maybe could you use your like a middle initial at least? And I said, well, listen, I have a short name. Let's go all the way. Roy Peter Clark. And back in, about 10 years ago, I met the country western star, and we were photographed together. Our pictures appeared in the Tampa Bay Times, and so we had a good laugh about that. Now, one other thing, if I may say, and this is what you get for asking me about my name, is that I sometimes I think a lot about names and the origins of names, and in real life and ones that are created. And so Roy comes from the sort of, the sort of French version of the word king. See the word royal, king. Peter comes from Petrus, the Apostle Peter. He's the rock. Mm-hmm. And Clark is related to the English word clerk or cleric, which is actually an occupational name like Miller or Smith. So a clerk in Chaucer's time was anybody who could read or write. So in short, finally, my name translates to King Rock Writer, and I'm stuck with that.
There you have it. There is a story behind the name, and a quite significant one. Now, let's talk about X-ray reading. I did a little verbal gesture drawing of what it is, Roy, but you go ahead and tell our listeners your description of X-ray reading.
So when I was a kid, I'm still a kid in many respects, I'll still occasionally read an old comic book, Superman or Batman or Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos or whatever it happens to be. And they used to have these gag gifts that you could order. And one of them were x-ray glasses. Supposedly, you'd order these glasses, you'd put them on, and it'd help you look through things. So I think one of the appeals to boys, like, you know, you could look through people's clothes and see everybody naked, and boys, I guess we're suckers for that.
I remember those. Interesting.
Yeah.
In fact, I was suckered in. I got them too. It's unbelievable what a young teenage boy will fall for.
Oh boy. So, but for me, it became a metaphor. And in classes, when I teach writers and teachers, I sometimes give out these metaphorical x-ray glasses. And I say, put them on. Now look at this text that you think so highly of, that you want to appreciate. And, you know, when we read a text, a literary text, if we're English majors like I was, I did a dissertation on the Canterbury Tales, you're trained to close read something and also to extract meaning from the text, themes, ways of looking at the world, those kinds of things, cultural history. I said, but there's another step that in literary analysis we too often miss, and that's to look beneath the surface of the text, to reverse engineer the text in a way, to use a different metaphor, to see all of the devices, all of the strategies that the writer is using to create the effects that we're feeling. Why am I laughing? Why am I crying? Why am I outraged? Why am I informed? A text is a contraption, in essence, created by a writer, a poet, a novelist, a journalist, using a variety of strategies. And those strategies have different names. We call them grammar and syntax and poetics and rhetoric and dialogue and narrative strategies and those kinds of things. Mm. And the idea is that close reading doesn't get you quite deep enough, but x-ray reading can do that. And what x-ray reading will do will turn a text into what high school teachers call a mentor text that reveals to you the strategies that you can now, the tools that you can put on your workbench. And I can think of an example without actually referring directly to the book. And it comes from an x-ray reading of Shirley Jackson's famous story, The Lottery, which is one of the most anthologized short stories of the 20th century. I don't know if people read it anymore. Written in 1948, appeared in the New Yorker magazine, and was greeted by readers who were outraged that such a terrible place could exist in America, a place where these terrible lottery rituals existed. I guess to do this, it has to be a spoiler alert, but we can't get around it, right?
No, go right ahead.
The winner of the lottery, Mrs. Hutchinson, as I recall, is stoned to death in the final passage of this short and terrifying story. And I remember reading it for the first time in high school and being horrified and terrified and slightly traumatized by this story, which felt so real that the readers, even of The New Yorker, overlooked the fact that it was fictionalized.
Right. And a sophisticated readership.
Yeah. Now, it is true, right, to put it in historical context, 3 years later, this is 3 years after the discovery of the concentration camps and what we now call the Holocaust. So the discovery of these scapegoating horrors was not too far from sort of recent history. But when you read, I don't have it in front of me. I'm doing this from my ancient memory. Mm-hmm. When you read the text, and it opens on this town square where this lottery is going to take place, and the boys are down by, I guess, by the lakefront, and they're stuffing stones in their pockets. Now, very often with foreshadowing, you have to read it twice to see what you didn't see the first time around. But there it was. In the second or third paragraph, these children who were stuffing rocks in their pocket, I thought maybe to play skipping stones, you know, across the lake or whatever.
Yep.
No. Uh-huh. They're getting ready to kill Mrs. Hutchinson. And so now I have a word, foreshadowing. It's a little different than foreboding, that allows me to see something in a text that I can name it, I can put it on my toolbox, in my workbench, and someday it's there if I need it. Now, that short story probably led me to a deeper X-ray reading of The Great Gatsby, which I write too much, so I forget these things. I believe that Gatsby is the first chapter in the book.
Yes, that is correct.
So when I wrote a book, Writing Tools, there's a chapter about endings, and there's a reference to the ending of The Great Gatsby, which is a famous, maybe one of the most famous endings of an American novel. People commit it to memory. There's our narrator, Nick Carraway, standing, I guess, on the shore of Long Island Sound to the spot where he saw Gatsby for the first time at one of his parties. Gatsby is looking out, and in the distance, he's reaching out, and he's reaching out to this green light, which turns out to be the light on the end of the pier on Daisy's house, his lost beloved. And I went back and read the ending of chapter one, and there was Gatsby looking out in that same spot, and the green light. So at the end of the first chapter and at the end of the novel, there is that green light. And in some illustrations that come out of Gatsby, the green light is sometimes used or evoked. Now, I said to myself, is it reasonable for an author in a 200-page novel to plant something at the end of chapter one and harvested 189 pages later? And I happened to be on Long Island visiting my mom, who was in an assisted living place that was probably walking distance from East Egg or West Egg. Um, I, where Gatz, all this happened, the north shore of Long Island. I'm on the Long Island Railroad, and I'm rereading the novel. And I come to the scene where Nick has arranged this lunch where Daisy and Gatsby are going to be reunited for the first time. And they meet, and Gatsby, making sort of casual conversation, says something about, mentions the green light. And she says, "What green light?" Because it doesn't have any meaning for her. And suddenly, the meaning of this light now, I don't know, becomes more complicated. But I happened to look at, I said, okay, there it is. And I happened to look at the page number. And this reference to the green light happens in the, if I can use this word, in the exact center of the novel. Can't remember what page it was. Exact center of the novel.
So that was a third reference. Is that right?
That was a third reference. But it was the second reference where Gatsby is saying, no, this green light isn't going to have enough meaning if I just plant it in the beginning and harvest it at the end. I've got to water it in the middle. I've got to remind the reader that it's a signifier. Mm-hmm. And boy, that's a rich strategy for me, Mike, is that a lot of us plant stuff in the middle, depending on the length of the story or the article or the essay. We harvest it at the end. We kind of make a circle. But, you know, when strategically does it make sense to remind the readers to have an echo of the beginning somewhere in the middle that now better prepares the reader for the payoff? That's X-ray reading to me.
You know who else does that? Well, a lot of people do it, but one of the famous writers who do it, contemporary writers, is John Irving, where he'll have like a phrase that's kind of a runner throughout his novel. Now, he normally would do it more than a few times, but yeah. You know what you're talking about, you know, when I write cover profiles, for example, for the magazine, I try to end it where I began it and create that circularity you're talking about, where there's a sense of completeness, like you've come full circle. But when you're doing long form writing like a novel, obviously, your point being that a lesson learned is that Fitzgerald understood that it's not going to make the impact, or maybe even have, maybe even wouldn't be recognized at the end of the novel if he didn't, as you say, water it there in the middle and make sure that the reader had captured that and tuned into it and was prepared for the final, not unwittingly prepared for the grand finale of the novel.
Yeah, no, it's a remarkable work, and but I think I was teaching a college class the other day from they're visiting Elon College, and I'm very tuned into to music, and I have a tiny little keyboard here. Would you be willing for me to try to? I just want to play about 15 seconds from a song. Would that work for you?
Go right ahead. Okay. We've never had a musical performance on here before. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, I bought this piano for $50. It weighs 2 pounds. I'm holding it in my hand. Can you hear that?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right.
It's kind of tinny.
Yeah. Well, it only weighs 2 pounds. Okay.
Not a lot of bass, not a lot of bottom end to this one.
All right, here, we'll give you a little bottom. Here we go. Ready? People will recognize that as Three Blind Mice, right?
Yes.
Well, I heard Wynton Marsalis teach that song to a group of children to teach them how to appreciate classical music. And what he taught them was that he took this little song and he slowed it down and he broke it up into its constituent parts. I would say he was X-ray listening to the song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he introduced the idea of a musical phrase. Hang on. Okay, so it goes. Here I am. That's repeated. Okay, then you have an elaboration of that phrase, not three notes, but four notes repeated. That's part two. Part three is a longer phrase repeated three times. It just seems like when you play it fast, like a blend, but I'm going to slow it down. One. Two. Three. And what's the end? What's the kicker? Right back where we started from.
Yeah. So
if you were to, if you wanted to, teach about the architecture of music or the architecture of stories, you could plot that song as AA, BB, CCC, A. And just as the Ring Trilogy, to use a much longer work, begins in the Shire, leads to a journey, returns to the Shire where things can never be the same again. Same with a novel like Siddhartha. This ring structure, this circle structure, where things are repeated but elaborated. It's so powerful, and I really like it when I can learn to appreciate it, not just from written texts, but from visual images.
Because it's communication, whether it's visual, auditory, or whether it's reading or looking at images rather than words. It's a communication technique that's really universal.
So you mentioned Robert McKee's
story by Robert McKee.
Yeah. Yes. So Robert McKee's book Story has just a wonderful, useful strategy, which he describes as the inciting incident. I love that because there are so many examples of it, not just in screenplays, but in all different kinds of fictional and nonfiction stories. I can't remember whether it's Frodo or Bilbo who is having the birthday party when Gandalf arrives, you know, and suddenly nothing is quite the same. At night, one of my rituals has been around 10 o'clock before I get sleepy. I watch an old episode of Law and Order, one of the original episodes. Mm-hmm. And highly structured, highly formulaic, right? And how does it begin? It begins with ordinary New Yorkers stumbling upon a corpse. Those New Yorkers have no other role usually than to do that. And then the cops come. And then halfway through, the lawyers get involved. And so this idea that anybody who's been in a car accident understands the inciting incident, because it changes the nature of your day. And your goal in real life is to restore order, restore normal life, to overcome the effects of the accident or the tragedy. So, you know, sometimes what the kind of thing we're talking about is dismissed as being like formulaic. But I do believe that it takes a formula to be an Olympic diver, you know, off the 3-meter platform or whatever. But it doesn't mean it's easy to do. It doesn't mean it's not beautiful to behold. It doesn't mean that there aren't wonderful variations along the way.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you've got, there are fundamentals of storytelling, and there are time, you know, time-tested, time-honored ways of telling a story. But then even within that, the X-ray reading that you talk about, for instance, the opening line of Moby Dick, which I'd like you to, such a simple line, it almost sounds like a throwaway in the beginning, but you do quite an analysis of it. And I want to say, before you do that, I want to say the reason why I feel like X-ray reading is such an important subject is that I hear over and over again people saying, if you want to be a good or great writer, write, just write, write, write. But the truth of the matter is it's critical to have good source material to read. I mean, when I was growing up as a basketball player, if somebody just said, you have to just practice, practice, practice. If I didn't watch Earl Monroe and Julius Erving and Walt Frazier and Oscar Robertson play basketball, I wouldn't have known any of those moves, any of those movements that turn you into a really good basketball player. And ditto for writing. It's like, if you're not reading high quality writing, to begin with, you're at a deficit if you're not reading good writing. But then secondly, just like we learn the English language or any language, it's emulation. And if we can't emulate, which is distinct from, of course, from what's the word I'm looking for, from plagiarism.
Yeah.
Emulation is different. You can use those same techniques. You're not going to talk about the green light, but that same technique used by Fitzgerald can be used by us, or Herman Melville's techniques. What about that opening line of Moby Dick? Call me Ishmael. Again, sounds almost like a throwaway. I could see an agent today, if you sent something like that out today and he or she wasn't familiar with Moby Dick, is like, what's that? The opening line is just a throwaway, but it's not at all in your reading of it.
So I have a story, which I was at a conference years ago, just pretty much when I was new to journalism. And I was sitting around an oval table, and the conference was being recorded. And it was about some issue or crisis in journalism. And I finished my commentary with a little joke where I said, you know, call me naive, call me irresponsible, call me Ishmael. So a month or so goes by, and they've created the transcript of the entire conference. And my boss brings it in and says, what is this? And I read it, and it says, call me naive, call me irresponsible, call me a schmuck. So that's the poor...
Something was lost in transcription.
Poor transcriber. But I guess that was my punishment for showing off my...
You got a little arcane. A little esoteric. Yeah.
So here's what I wrote. And I think it says, the short sentence as gospel is the subtitle for this in the book. It says, call me Ishmael. What makes that a perfect sentence? I can make a list. One, it is a short, short sentence within a long, long novel. Two, it introduces the first person narrator. Three, it has an oddly potent structure, not the standard subject, verb, object. When I tried to decipher the syntax, the best I could come up with was imperative verb, indirect object, and I haven't the foggiest idea. the experts at languagelog.com steered me toward, quote, verb, direct object, and the always popular predicate complement, unquote. Number four, the sentence has some mystery to it. The narrator doesn't give you his real name, and you wonder why. Number five, it introduces a biblical allusion, one that points to an outcast, alienated son, Ishmael from the Old Testament. Then I write, that is so much work done so efficiently. Author Tom Wolfe once argued that when readers confront a short, short sentence, they treat it as the gospel truth. At the Poynter Institute, we call this the, quote, Jesus wept effect, a reference to one of the shortest sentences in the Bible. When Jesus returns home to discover that his cousin Lazarus has died, his response is profoundly human. Many who may doubt the miracle of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead are less likely to doubt this moment, quote, Jesus wept. The simple power of two words, subject and verb, should encourage us to cast our most important ideas in the shortest possible sentences. So I haven't read that little passage in probably since I wrote the book. And having read it, I have to say it feels pretty good to me. So if I'm...
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's why I singled it out. I thought your analysis of it, how you broke it down that way. And then another one is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath, which I just got done, incidentally. You mentioned Shirley Clark. I'm sorry, Shirley Jackson earlier. And Shirley Jackson, I read her biography recently. And Red Comet is the name of the Sylvia Plath, huge biography. I mean, really, it's a big book. It's written by Heather Clark. That's why I called it, not because you're here, Roy, but Heather Clark is the name of the author of Red Comet, Sylvia Plath's biography, or one of them. But it's a big, it's considered to be maybe the mm-hmm. definitive one because it's huge. Agonizing because you know what the ending is,
sure.
But it's such a journey to get there. But that opening line of the novel she wrote called The Bell Jar, and I'll just go ahead and read it and have you launch from there. It goes like this. It was a queer, sultry summer. The summer they electrocuted the Rosenbergs. And I don't know what I was doing in New York.
Yeah, you know, when you said... I have the book with me, and I was just flipping through it to the section on Sylvia Plath. And this is kind of a my mother, whose name was Shirley Clark, always described herself. She was a good Catholic lady who always thought she was like clairvoyant, and she would say that I'm a witch, Roy. Your mother's a witch. And as I was flipping through. I happened to come across the dedication page. And when you said the name Shirley Clark, I read, to my brothers Vincent Clark and Ted Clark, for their tender care of our mom, Shirley Clark, who at age 95 was still singing. So that's a, I have little chills on my arm here. So that you spoke her name by mistake mm-hmm. just at the moment that I saw it. And she is kind of part of my analysis or understanding or curiosity or obsession with The Bell Jar and those opening lines. I write at length.
And this is actually I'll just throw this in, Roy, that this is a blending of historical fact, the Rosenbergs being executed, and something that bothered her a great deal in her life, and fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And so let's. I mean, one of the thing about a writing tool So my book Writing Tools is the first in a sequence of these books that I did for Little Brown. And it's by far the most popular best-selling of the books. Been translated into Arabic and Chinese, and rarely does a day go by when I don't hear from a reader of that. And one of my favorite strategies, number two in the chapters, is order words for emphasis. And I often refer to a very short sentence in Shakespeare's Macbeth. And I just, our family just watched the Denzel Washington version and the new version just the other night. So it came home to me. And at the end of the play, just before Macbeth is about to be beheaded for his crime of his Lady Macbeth, his wife, kill the king, assassinate him. She dies of insanity. And there's a scream off stage, and someone comes on and says, the queen, my lord, is dead. I became fascinated with that line. I want to punctuate it. The queen, comma, my lord, comma, is dead, period, or what the Brits would call full stop. Mm-hmm. And my first impulse was that was written by a playwright for an actor to deliver. There are other versions. The versions that I would have written, the queen is dead, my lord. I could have also written, my lord, the queen is dead, and Yoda might have declared, dead, the queen is. But Shakespeare's version is the only one with two commas in it. Now, I'm X-ray reading those six words. And so, mm-hmm. So what it gives me is something really important at the beginning, the subject, the queen. Something less important, my lord, in the middle, and something very important at the end, is dead, period. Stick the landing, drop the mic. And it turns out that emphatic word order, as Strunk and White have it, I think, place the most important words in a sentence at the end, which is another example. Or mm-hmm. How about the way we tell jokes? I dropped my toothpaste, he said, crestfallen. Or how about Michelle Obama saying in a speech, in oratory, I woke up this morning in a house that was built by slaves, period, the White House. So we have all these examples in different forms of writing where the emphatic word comes at the end. Okay? Now, but that doesn't always apply. And that's the good thing about a writing tool as opposed to a writing rule. So when Sylvia Plath gives us, it was a queer, sultry summer, the summer they electrocuted the Rosenbergs, and I didn't know what I was doing in New York. You know, when I read that, in a bookstore not that long ago, I said, oh my goodness, the Rosenbergs. Now, I have to reveal that the Rosenbergs, when they were arrested for espionage, giving aid supposedly to Russia, the Soviet Union, they were living in a large apartment complex on the Lower East Side of New York called Knickerbocker Village. And so were we. Okay? Mm-hmm. I lived there for the first 4 years of my life. I was there the same time as the Rosenbergs' two sons. When they were electrocuted, my Uncle Pete and my Aunt Millie were on a waiting list for an apartment, and they got that. They wound up having their first apartment before they had their children in the Rosenbergs' apartment. So it's an odd and rare and personal connection. So the Rosenbergs were always on my mind, but they've been on everybody's mind. There's a new novel called The Vixen, in which Ethel plays an important role. She's a character in the play Angels in America. There's a new biography about her. Roy Cohn, who was Senator McCarthy's legal hitman and was Donald Trump's father's lawyer, you know, and so all of these connections. But what I think is so fascinating is that, yes, you can put a bump in the road, right? You can plant in the middle of an otherwise straightforward sentence a mystery that has to be solved. And that mystery is solved to go exactly the same way with a slightly different geometry, I suppose, than The Great Gatsby, which is that the character played by the fictional character who is Sylvia Plath winds up talking to somebody. She's young. She's working at a magazine. She's in New York. Kind of bad things are happening to her. And she makes a comment about how horrible, what a horrible thing it is that this execution is going to take place. And her friend, who sees it a different way, says something like, yes, isn't it horrible that such people could exist, that is the Rosenbergs, on the face of the earth? Later in the novel, sorry about this, because it's a spoiler, after an attempt to commit suicide, as she eventually would in her real life, she wakes up in a sanatorium, a mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And she finds herself being led down a hallway with bars on the window, strapped to a table, with electrodes strapped to her head, where they administer, you know, not with wicked intent, but they administer electric shock therapy to her. And
back when it was very crude, treatment back then.
Yeah. And says to herself, and the novelist says, you know, I wondered what terrible thing I had done to receive such punishment. So what do we have? We have the Rosenbergs planted, the electrocution planted in the first sentence. It echoes a little later, and then essentially she becomes the Rosenbergs. She becomes essentially the one who is tied down and electrocuted. It's a high level of artistic achievement from probably one of the most troubled writers who ever lived. And that's saying something.
Yeah, it really is. Now, and that was, I believe, her only novel. She wrote a lot of poetry. And I think that was, I may be wrong mm-hmm. about that, but that obviously a celebrated novel.
She's
well known for it. But I think it was the only one she wrote. I may be wrong again. You know, you talk about the power of short sentences. One of the things, we don't have time for you to get into this part, but your description of the beginning of The Sun Also Rises, that's another terrific, I'm inviting everybody to get your hands on this book, and the analysis of that beginning and seeing it through the x-ray eyes of Roy Peter Clark, it's a different reading. It's a whole different reading versus looking at it. And it has a lot to do with reading for not just for story, but reading for structure, reading for intent, reading for hidden meaning, and so on. You know, you do say, Roy, read poetry. You think that that's kind of the highest level. It invite not only invites, but requires x-ray reading. And then you also talk about reading the Bible, and not for religious purposes to make people religious or more religious, you say, but there is. So why don't you talk about both of those, poetry and the Bible? Why are those two of the things that you think people can really bone up on to improve their writing?
Yeah, I want to mention, Mike, just because she recently died, that in my chapter on Hemingway is called X-Ray, Hemingway, and Didion. And so
that's right.
The chapter contains an analysis, a paragraph of her analysis of the opening of Hemingway's novel. So it's so interesting. It became a kind of, for me, a sort of like a double X-raying, which is I'm watching Joan Didion watching Hemingway. Mm-hmm. And a double meta dance, or kind of a literary menage, where she is seeing things that are invisible to me, but she's helping me. She's giving me lenses. She's sharpening my vision. And I think that's a powerful thing. I mean, the great thing about reading the Bible or listening to stories or thinking about stories in the Bible is that it turns us back to writing, which happened, you know, more than 2,000 years ago, which still bear, which helped invent the strategies and the modes and the methods and the themes that we still depend upon. Okay, so are you a Seinfeld fan?
I am. I've seen the show sometimes. I'm not a huge watcher of TV series.
Okay,
but I'm familiar with the show. So I am familiar.
In the last episode, which some people like, I think it had two parts. The last episode, the four main characters are put on trial, and they're prosecuted for a crime. I'll describe it in just a second. But it enables the directors and the showrunners to bring back all of the characters who these our main characters have screwed over 7, 8, or 9 years. Like, you know, it's very, very funny. But they violate, in I think Lowell, Massachusetts, the Good Samaritan law, where instead of helping this fat man who is being mugged, they ridicule him while it's going on, and they're busted. And what I thought was, oh my gosh, here is this highly comedic, irreverent story. And what is it kind of based upon? It's based upon the parable of the Good Samaritan, which receives very, very careful, respectful treatment, honored treatment. I believe in my book, I write too much, so I lose track of where things go, How to Write Short.
Yes.
Because the parable is something like, actual parable is like 148 words. And when I x-ray read that, what I see is I sort of honor Jesus or whoever the actual writer was as being as sort of a highly efficient and skilled storyteller. There's a man who's going down from Jerusalem to Jericho along this pathway, and he's just doing his thing. And we don't know anything about the man, and suddenly he comes upon a man in a ditch. Look, why is that different than the opening of Law and Order?
Exactly.
The man isn't dead, but he's dying. And two other men have passed him by. But this third man, the sort of sacred number three, picks him up. And by the way, we learn that the man is a Samaritan, which means that he is a despised outsider to the Jewish tribes. So it's not a countryman or a tribesman who helps the man. It's this stranger. And the stranger has three things with him, three details that we learn that are focused on his own comfort. He has a donkey or a beast of burden. He has wine and oil. And he has gold coins, Roman coins, denarii. Right? And instead of using them on himself, he washes the man's wounds with the wine and the oil. He puts him on his donkey. He leads him into an inn. And he pays the innkeeper, says, on the way back, I'll check in. If this isn't enough, I'll give you more. So this is all in response to the lawyer's question of Jesus, like, you say I should love my neighbor, but who is my neighbor? And so this kind of abstraction of neighborliness comes this amazing story, which becomes embodied in our language 2,000 years later. If there's no other reason, if I haven't given enough evidence as why you should read the Bible or think about Bible stories, I don't have anything better than that.
Right, right. And it's timeless. You know, I find more and more when I write that I don't want timestamps in the copy. I don't want references to virtual reality goggles or texting or what have you, because all of a sudden it timestamps it.
Yeah.
Where it's a certain period of time, or it's outmoded suddenly because we don't text anymore. We use telepathy. And there are certain things that are timeless. And for instance, just the interactions between people, sans technology or sans any kind of technology. So, yeah. So that the piece of writing actually can stand the test of time, not just because it's a good quality writing or it's a good story, but it actually doesn't jolt the reader into thinking, oh, this is back when they had to hand crank a car.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I didn't realize that until now, sort of thing. What about poetry?
Well, you know, I'll put it this way. I think I treat all texts as poetry. I think the difference between poetry and prose is the compression of meaning and language. But that doesn't have to make it just literary. It can make it practical as well. And here I'm thinking that titles, headlines, headline writers have an important meaning to make within a short space. And titles, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a television franchise from the 90s, I thought was remarkable in part just for the very language of the title, where you have these two elements, the vampire slayer, you know, and who is not like Dr. Von Helsing, who's a German philosopher, but a 16-year-old California high school girl, like with the name Buffy. So now, the man who, Joss Whedon, who created that title, knew that you could put two things together that didn't belong together. But T.S. Eliot has his title as well. And his title for a famous poem written 100 years ago is The Love Song. Not of Romeo and Juliet, not of Casanova. It's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, a very cold British banker's name, two things that don't go along together. So when it came time to write my book for Little Brown about grammar, I had a concept of grammar that I wanted to capture in the way a poet might capture it. And so an author doesn't always get to choose their title, right? Fitzgerald wanted to call The Great Gatsby Trimalchio at West Egg. So let's thank Maxwell Perkins, his editor, for talking him out of it. But my title was The Glamour of Grammar, which is probably my favorite title for one of my own books. And yes, it works on the same premise. Two things that don't belong together are placed together and they rub. And that rub creates a friction, creates heat, creates light, creates energy, a little dissonance. And it's a source of creativity in music, in the visual arts, and in language.
Mm-hmm. And I know one of the writers you greatly respect because you analyze his work is Vladimir Nabokov. Mm-hmm. And the first, when you talk about, you know, writing prose being poetry, the first 20 or 30 pages of Lolita are some of the greatest writing I've ever read. I mean, it's just phenomenal. It was kind of this fusion of prose and poetry. And it was just incredible. You know, we're running long here, Roy, okay. But I want to thank you for taking the time discussing X-ray reading. The book is beautifully written. Now I know I need to get onto writing tools. If they're reading it in the Arab world and everywhere else, I'm going to have to add that one to my list as well. So thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
Mike, if you want to talk about writing tools someday, call me back. We'll do this again.